I don't know about you, but what I come into church and I wonder, okay, we give sometimes 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes, something like that, to a thing called a sermon. And I'm wondering what you think the sermon should do. So I want you to turn to the person beside you, even if you're related to her and or him. And if you're not close to someone, just get yourself close to somebody and ask that question. What do you think the sermon should do on a Sunday? And I'm going to give you 2 minutes. Actually, I may only give you one, so you better get started. Okay, I told you I wasn't going to give you long. Anybody feel brave enough just to shout out an answer? And if it's, you didn't get enough sleep, and so the sermon's there for you to get a little more sleep. No, it's, I won't even go there. Someone? Okay, encouragement and challenge. Who said that? Oh, Kenneth? Okay, thank you. Dig into the word so that you can apply it. And applications. Other things? Jack, I think that was you. Unite us? Enlighten us. I'm sorry. You get my age, and not only your knees go, but your ears too. So, anything else? It should draw you closer to God. Okay. A collective, like all of us, encounter with God. I just want to tell you, I'm quitting. Anything else? Inspire us. Okay. Make us able to fly. No. Okay. Penny says friendship. To increase our friendship? Okay. Okay, so thank you for that. You've just set the bar up here, and the good news is that God's bar, he doesn't have a bar. He just goes for wherever it is. I am not saying that I will reach any of those things, but I do want to say it takes two for a sermon. And you got to play your part. And so I do, if there's something I say and you really disagree with it, you got to tell me afterwards. If there's something that I say that encourages you and you want to tell me afterwards, fine. And encourage, which is good. But a sermon is always... it's not just me speaking. It's actually what's happening out here. In this passage, we hear that something about worship has something to do with spirit and truth. And the spirit, friends, is here. The spirit is here because you're here, and we each, we've all been created in the image of God, and we have something of him with us. And those of you who our followers of Jesus have invited the Spirit to come and live within you. And so the Spirit is here and working. And I want to encourage you to listen to the Spirit. The title of this morning sermon is, Could He Be the Messiah? So, okay, yes, he is. And that's it, okay? So I'm just going to leave now because that you know that he's the Messiah. That's the answer to the question. But maybe not quite. Messiah is an interesting word. In the Greek, it's Christ. And so we have Jesus Christ, or Jesus the Christ. We also have Jesus the Messiah. We also have Jesus the Anointed One. So those three words, Anointed, Messiah, and Christ, sort of are together. And they are words which talk about God's ordination in some ways, or God placing upon, giving Jesus the Spirit to go and do the works of God. The Messiah part is also, in some theological structures, the Messiah part is more prophetic, and is they think of the Messiah more as perhaps in the last days there will be a Messiah. And part of what's happening within the Jewish community when Jesus is there is that the Messiah is amongst them and something big is happening. That something big that is happening took 3 years in some ways, actually took the life of Jesus, but the part that we seem to focus in on most is the 3 years of his ministry and then of his death and his resurrection. And now we live in anticipation of him coming back again. And so that gives you a little bit of the background of the word. I'm not going to try to explain all the theological ramifications, because I'm not very theological, of Jesus being the Messiah, but I do want to ask questions. What do we learn about Jesus in this context of this story? What do we learn about the woman and her context? What do we learn about God? What do we learn about ourselves? And one of the questions that I, as we get going, I want to just mention to you is I want you to keep on wondering, who are you in the story? Who are you in the story? Are you the woman? Are you actually Jesus? Do you more identify with Jesus and what he's doing? Are you, you know, those are the two that are in this part of the story, but we know that the disciples are in town. Do you feel like you're a disciple? Or are you, eventually, we also know that the townspeople and the woman come back in the second act of this little play. And are you one of those folks? So who are you in the story is the background question. I want to read just, again, Alan, thank you for reading so well. I'm just going to do that and then make comments as I go through. So the first part that I want to make comments on is verses 4, John 4, 1 to 3. So now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized his disciples, but his disciples. Just a comment. If there's someone who wants to be the focus of all the activity, focus of all the things that are happening, you might question their leadership style in one way. Jesus right here is giving away leadership. The disciples are the ones who are baptizing. He's actually pushing them out into that sort of thing. So he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. Some of you are aware of your biblical geography, thank you. If you're familiar with that, you know that Jerusalem is down in the bottom, and up at the top is the Sea of Galilee, and Samaria is sort of in the middle. And most Jews would not go through Samaria. So when he says, now he had to go through Jerusalem, or through Samaria, it is, it actually is not true. If he was really concerned about his Jewishness at that point, if he was concerned about his Jewishness, he would have gone away over to one side, and then up over the other side, and then back in at the top, which is a much longer route. But he didn't. He went straight through. And in fact, it was the shortest route that he took. And I know that some of you know I work in the downtown east side, and I'm not going to talk very much about the downtown east side, but I think the downtown east side sometimes could be compared to like a Samaria, because most people think there's nothing very good down there. Most people think that every person down there is basically bad, that they're, it's a dangerous place. And you know that Samaria is also the place where the Good Samaritan parable happens. And in that parable, you get this idea that there's this dangerous road to travel when you go through there. You might get mugged. I think there's many people. In fact, I know of a person, a supporter, not anyone here, who really finds it difficult just to be down there. And there's all sorts of personal reasons, but one of them is the fear of not being safe, of what might happen. So Samaria was that type of place. It was not a very good welcoming place. You know, there weren't a lot of Tim Hortons as you went through there. It was much more a place that there were pawn shops as you went through there, or whatever else you want to sort of ascribe to that area. So he had to go to Samaria, but he really didn't. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his sons Joseph, Jacob's well was there, and Jesus tried, as he was tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. And this is Maya's point with the kids' story. Why does she come in the heat of the day? Could be she was not only a woman, but also was an outcast, perhaps being immoral, but this is never really said in the story. But it is weird that she's coming at noon in the heat of the day. It'd be like us on a desert going at noon, which is or 3 or 4 o'clock, depending on where you are in the earth, and it's the hottest part of the day. So it doesn't make sense. So the writer puts that in there, and it sort of helps us speculate what might be happening at that point. And then I call this the first climax of the story. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" And then this little bracketed part, his disciples had gone into the town to buy food. "Will you give me a drink?" Jesus, what are you doing? Why are you, first of all, engaging in a conversation, in fact, starting the conversation with someone like a Samaritan? And not only a Samaritan, but a woman. There were Pharisees who were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Do you want to know why they were called that? Because when they saw a woman, they would shut their eyes, and they would keep walking, and they would fall, and they'd run into trees. But they did not want to see a woman. Because if they saw the woman, it's a little bit like they were flipping back to Adam and Eve and saying in themselves, if I see that woman, I'm going to get tempted. There's going to be something. And it was this, they had this unfortunate attitude towards women. Jesus messes up that attitude because even in his genealogy, he allows for Matthew and Luke to involve women into the genealogy. And women who were of quote-unquote ill repute. Women who we might not consider friends. Women who we might consider as outcasts. And so, what is Jesus trying to do? Well, number one, I think he's trying to tell us he's thirsty. Here is the creator of the world. Here is the creator of all the water in the world saying, as he is confined to this human form, I'm thirsty. And he's, I think it's a legit question. Now, some people might say, oh, he's just trying to set up the whole thing. I think he's thirsty. And he asks the person, what does that do to the person who he is asking? Well, you get to it when she says, "Sir, you have no, will you give me?" The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew. I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." She's astounded, first of all, that he asks her. Right? This is just a little side. You can just throw it out if you want. But my frustration sometimes when it comes to when we gather together to talk about quote-unquote evangelism is that we always think that we got to have to, it's the answer that we got to get to. And it really, if you want to revamp your sort of evangelistic style, think about what the questions are that you can ask. Think about the fact of where the points of contact are. So yes, Jesus is divine and he's human. But where is the point of contact with the woman? It's in the humanity at that point. I am thirsty. Like you get thirsty. And so there is this sense in which there's a vulnerability that Jesus starts with. And that vulnerability is, I'm thirsty. So then she says, yes, well, if you knew the gift. And Jesus uses this thing of living water. Difference between Jacob's well and living water, yes, there's a metaphor happening here in the whole spiritual thing, living water being spiritual, Jacob's well being quite physical and geographical. The other thing is, though, the words that are used, the Jewish folks in that area, when they would use the term living water, they would think of a stream. And a stream is much more, it's usually colder, it is more pure because it's moving, rather than a still well that you have to drop a bag in. And so that's the first thing that happens. She says, can you give me a drink? Then you have nothing to, and then she says, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and livestock? She's sort of saying, come on, mister. First, you don't have a bag to draw the water with. And are you really greater than our ancestry? As the people in our past? Now, do you ever think that? Do you think people can be greater than the people who have been in your past? My hunch is that we most of the time don't think about that question. Although, perhaps, in the little bits of Mennonite culture that I have picked up being here since, about 30 years, it seems to me that for a lot of Mennonites, history is really important. And actually, this is not a bad thing, okay? Don't hear me saying it's a bad thing. It's just that not every culture is like that. And part of it, now, I come from a culture which, if I was still in Scotland, it would be the same thing. I'd be looking for who was the clan, who was the clan chief in 1700, and am I anything like him or whatever. Fortunately, I'm not. Anyways, so this idea that she's appealing, she's sort of saying, first of all, you don't have anything to draw with. You don't have anything. You can't get the water. And second of all, are you better? Are you greater? Are you, more? Are you stronger? Maybe, I don't know if that's quite the right word either. But than our forefather, Jacob. I love, and I've said this before. I love when I'm involved with First Nations things in the Downtown East Side, because they end everything with this, what I think is a lovely phrase called "All my relations." They'll say, all my relations at the end. It's sort of like their amen, which means so be it. But all my relations is just trying to remind them that we don't stand alone. We always stand with our families in some ways and the people that we've come from. So Jesus responds, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Again, Jesus teases out the difference between the physical water of Jacob's well and the spiritual water that he can bring to people's lives. And he continues the conversation. It's a great story to look at and just see how Jesus involves himself in this woman's life in a way that actually he goes from, not knowing this person at all to actually knowing her quite deeply. And she starts not knowing Jesus at all. And if you go to the second half of the story, you discover that she gets to know Jesus quite well. And then wants to tell others about him. Anyways, so then she says, sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. He told her, go call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. How do you think she says her line? I get the impression she is really involved with the conversation and is very intrigued with Jesus. And then Jesus touches a point of reality for her, which is painful. He touches something which she was not expecting that he was going to touch. Now, it could be, we don't know this for sure, but that could be the point of why she's an outcast. because she's had so many husbands and she's living with a guy now who's not her husband. It's not necessarily so, but it seems like it could be. And it's not. So Jesus somehow touches her at a place where rarely anybody talks to her about, except in very condemning ways. So anyways, I would think, go call your husband and come back. What is God the Father asking us to do? What is it that's broken in us that we need to go and ask God about? Is this one way that perhaps we identify with the woman? Is this one way that we have, is it relationships within our families? Again, I talk to a lot of people, or I try to listen to a lot of people, and I would say 80% of the people that I listen to are talking about a mother or a father who basically was not a good mother, was not a good father, and the person is talking in this way of, I have deep pain because of this relationship that didn't work. It could also be a sister, could be a brother, could be an uncle, an aunt, any number of those in that constellation of the family. And I'm not saying everything comes out of the family like that, but in this case, and in what I think Jesus is pushing at, it is the sense in which he's pushing and touching her to take off the mask that Maya had here. He's actually saying, if you're going to come and get this water, you're going to have to come in a vulnerable way. You cannot come in a proud way. You cannot come in a way that says you have it all together. You come and say, what does she say? She says, Jesus said to her, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you have had five husbands and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is quite true. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Interesting. We're going along this direction. And Jesus says, what you have said is quite true. And then she goes, zoop, I don't want to go there. Let's talk about theology. Let's talk about religion. Let's talk about those safe things. And so what happens is that I love the fact that Jesus affirms her. He does not condemn her. Come on, you're not telling me the whole truth here. He doesn't say that. He says, what you've said is quite true. Do we look for those places where we can affirm people? Or do we look for the places where we know we can nail them? I'm just being, I think there are times when I look for the places to affirm, but I think there are times as well when I'm in a bad space where I sort of think, that's not true. I'm going to tell that person that's not true. And Jesus, in his way of working in this conversation, he actually affirms her. And I would love to be able to affirm people more than I do. I want to suggest as well, Jesus did not come to... this is actually from Richard Rohr, which I think is really important. Jesus did not come to change the mind of God about humanity. Jesus wasn't trying to say, God, they're so much better. They're really good. He's not trying to change God's mind. And as Rohr says, it does not need changing. Jesus came to change the mind of humanity about God. We need to have our minds changed about who we think God is. And I think that's part of our conversion, friends. I think it's an ongoing conversion. And what I mean by that is, yes, at our conversion, we have something that happens and we take a step forward to God, but our entire life and perhaps all eternity will be a place of us learning more and more about the 3-in-1 eternal one, the light, the eternal light, And it will be us getting to know more about him. And I'll just say it again. Jesus did not come to change the mind of God about humanity. Jesus came to change the mind of humanity about God. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship. Now, Jesus gets very specific here. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship him in spirit and truth. Jesus takes the conversation to another place at this point, and he tells her that Samaritans do not know what they worship, and that the Jews do know, and they know that salvation comes from the Jews, but he's not saying, and please hear this, it is not only for the Jews, and that the true worshipers who worship God will worship God in spirit and truth. What will that mean for us when we say that we're going to worship God in spirit and in truth? See, I'm going to keep going back to this idea of vulnerability, because I think that the only way that we get to worshiping God in spirit and in truth is when we're vulnerable to God and when we're vulnerable with each other. Some denominations obviously think this means much more energy, much more demonstrative stuff happening. Some believe that you've got to be more silent. You've got to be more quiet. It's all different sort of ways of doing it. But what will it mean for you? What will it mean for Killarney Park? Then we come to the end. The woman said, I know the Messiah called Christ. This is where you get this figure of the words meaning the same, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. John is being very blunt with his audience when he has Jesus say, I am. Because everyone in the audience is going to know that he's referring to the fact of the I am. Who are you, God? I am who I am. So we get to the climax of Act 1 in this two-part play, where in Act 1, Jesus and the woman are the people on the stage, and in Act 2, Jesus and his disciples, and then the townspeople and the woman. I'm not going to go back and ask you if any of your ideals of what a sermon should do were accomplished in this thing. I had basically one point. That is that we worship a God who searches for us. We worship a God who knows us intimately. We worship a God who wants to be known. And we come to him lots of times thinking that we don't have to be known. But of course it doesn't actually work that way. We have to be known by him and by ourselves and by others.